Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson. Today, we're doing something pretty crucial, a really intense, granular look at everything the U.S. federal government has done, action by action, since the start of October 11th, 2025. This is the Federal News Update for Sunday, October 12th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. You know, the mission today is vital. We need to give you a truly comprehensive, exhaustive report on these last couple of days.
Yeah.
Because this period, it's likely the moment this government shutdown stopped being just, well, a funding problem.
Yeah.
And really turned into something else, a deliberate tool for political, maybe even ideological change. We're on day 11 of this shutdown, but what happened Friday and Saturday? It's completely reset the game.
Absolutely. We're moving past the usual shutdown script, you know, the furloughs, the close parks, important as those are.
Yeah.
We really need to dig into the deeper systemic shifts here. The actions taken were, frankly, unprecedented in how fast and how far they went.
Right. We need to understand the nitty-gritty details, the immediate impacts, and crucially, what this means long-term for government stability.
Okay, so to frame this for everyone listening, there are really three huge things, kind of interlocking developments that happened in this 48-hour window.
Exactly. First, the administration officially started mass, permanent layoffs. They call them RIFs, reductions in force. Over 4,200 federal employees terminated. Permanently, that's the ideological move, turning this temporary crisis into potentially a lasting change in government structure.
Okay, permanent layoffs. That's number one. What's second?
Second, the White House made a strategic move to remove the biggest pressure point to end the shutdown, military pay.
Wow.
They found a way, using repurposed R&D funds, to make sure active duty troops get their October 15th paychecks.
Ah, very strategic. Takes the heat off, in a way.
Immensely.
Yeah.
And third, as if the domestic situation wasn't chaotic enough, the president suddenly ramped up geopolitical tensions in a huge way,
yeah,
threatening 100% tariffs on essentially all Chinese imports.
Wow. Okay, so you've got this major international economic crisis potentially layered right on top of the domestic shutdown mess.
Precisely. It's a dual crisis. Okay, so let's start unpacking that first point, the RIFs. This really was a norm-shattering move against the civilian workforce.
Let's get right into the details of these permanent layoffs, because unprecedented really feels like the right word here. So October 10th, October 11th, the White House officially announces these RIFs are starting.
And the OMB director, Russell Hodd, wasn't exactly subtle about it. He just bluntly posted online, quote, "The RIFs have begun, period."
So help us understand the weight of that. How is the RIF different from what usually happens in a shutdown, the furloughs?
It's fundamentally different, and that's critical. In every shutdown we've seen before, federal workers are furloughed. That's basically temporary unpaid leave. But crucially, there's always been this legal understanding and historical precedent that Congress will provide back pay once the government reopens. Everyone expects to get paid eventually.
Okay, so a furlough is temporary with expected back pay.
Right. A RIF, a reduction in force, is permanent termination. It's getting fired. It cuts through the usual civil service protections. It's not a temporary inconvenience. It's potentially the end of someone's career, effective immediately. No more pay, no benefits, gone.
And the administration had sort of a two-pronged message for why they were doing this, didn't they?
Yeah, it was interesting. Publicly, the message was very much, this is unavoidable. It's a direct result of the Democrat-led government shutdown. Our hands are tied financially. That was the line designed to shift blame.
Oh, there was another layer to it.
Oh, definitely. At the same time, internally, and even in some comments to reporters, the president was framing it very differently. He explicitly said the layoffs were targeted, politically motivated. He mentioned laying off people that the Democrats want, even saying the cuts were Democrat-oriented because we figure, you know, they started this thing.
Hmm. So one message for the public financial necessity, and another is suggesting it's about targeting political opponents or areas. How did they square that circle?
Well, they didn't really try to square it. They mostly just pushed past the contradiction. The strategy seemed less about a solid legal or financial justification and more about seizing a political opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Using the shutdown, which is supposed to be about a temporary funding gap,
right,
as a lever to permanently eliminate programs and staff that didn't align with the administration's goal of, you know, shrinking the federal government and hitting specific regulatory functions.
And when you look at where the cuts actually happened, those 4,200 plus jobs, it really does seem to show specific priorities.
Absolutely. These weren't across the board cuts. They were deep and they were targeted. They went right for agencies involved in regulation, collecting revenue, social programs. Hmm. The Treasury Department got hit hardest, 1,446 employees let go.
And within Treasury, a huge chunk was the IRS, right?
Yeah, about 1,300 IRS workers. Firing tax experts right before the big October 15th tax extension deadline. That's guaranteed to cause maximum disruption.
It seems almost designed to disrupt.
It certainly has that effect. And beyond the IRS numbers, within Treasury, the administration specifically said they were targeting the entire Community Development Financial Institutions Fund, the CDFI, Fund for Abolition in this RIF. It's not just cutting staff, that's wiping out a whole program aimed at boosting growth in underserved communities.
Well, okay, so Treasury was hit hard. What about agencies dealing with health, education, housing? Those areas often targeted for cuts.
Same story there, unfortunately. Health and Human Services, HHS, lost up to 1,200 employees. That hits everything from public health initiatives to regulatory oversight. The Department of Education lost 466 people. That's over 20% of their remaining staff.
20%? That's huge.
It is. And Housing and Urban Development, HUD, lost 442 employees. And reports indicated the cuts specifically targeted the office focused on fair housing and equal opportunity.
So the pattern seems pretty clear. Regulatory functions, social programs, revenue collection, those are the bullseyes. It even extended to some security agencies.
That's a really important point. Homeland Security, DHS, terminated the 176 people. And the target there was reportedly CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
CISA, they handle critical infrastructure protection, election security.
Exactly. An agency the administration had publicly criticized before, particularly around election misinformation work. So hitting CISA plus cuts at Commerce 315 gone, an Energy 187 cut, it shows that even areas vital for modern security and infrastructure weren't off limits if they clashed with political aims.
But the biggest immediate firestorm, the one that seemed to generate the most public shock, was the cuts at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That whole situation really highlighted the tension between ideology and, well, basic public safety.
It was absolutely stunning. Initially, the CDC saw around 1,300 employees get these termination notices. And we're not talking about back office staff here. These were the specialists, the scientists at the core of the CDC's mission. Notices went to key leaders in areas like respiratory diseases, chronic diseases, injury prevention, global health.
And some of the specific teams targeted were just jaw-dropping.
Without a doubt. The ones that got the most attention were the 70 officers in the Epidemic Intelligence Service, the EIS. These are the CDC's famous disease detectives, the boots on the ground for outbreaks here and overseas.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Critical people.
Absolutely critical. But maybe even more alarming from an institutional standpoint was the termination of the entire staff of the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, the MMWR.
Wait, the entire MMWR staff, that's the journal that tracks diseases, right? Didn't they first report on AIDS?
That's the one. It's the publication for tracking health threats, spotting new outbreaks, to fire the entire team. It's an almost unthinkable blow to America's ability to even see the next pandemic coming. It felt like dismantling the nation's smoke detector.
And it wasn't just surveillance, right? Weren't they firing people actively working on current outbreaks?
Yes. That was the other truly shocking part. Notices went out to senior staff who were literally leading the responses to an ongoing measles outbreak in the U.S. and an active Ebola outbreak response overseas, firing the people fighting current epidemics. That crossed the line for almost everyone.
That does seem like an untenable position, politically and ethically.
And it proved to be. The backlash was immediate and fierce. By Saturday, October 12th, just a day or so after the notices went out, a federal health official announced that some of those CDC layoff notices had been sent in error and were being reversed.
Which ones got reversed?
Specifically, the notices for the EIS officers of the disease detectives, the entire MMWR team, and crucially, the key leaders working on those active measles and Ebola responses. The official reason given was some kind of administrative miscoding.
Miscoding? Does that sound plausible for such high-profile specific cuts?
It's difficult to say definitively. Was it truly a massive administrative blunder? Or was it a very quick political calculation? A realization that they'd pushed too far, hit a nerve that was politically radioactive and needed to retreat immediately.
So incompetence or a rapid backtrack?
Either way, the result is the same. It shows the administration isn't totally immune to pressure, especially when its actions look like they're directly endangering public health in such a blatant way. And importantly, this whole episode kind of created a playbook for opponents.
How so?
It showed exactly which lines, if crossed, would generate enough heat to force a reversal. highlighting the disease detectives, the MMWR, the active outbreak responders that worked, it became clear that those functions were perhaps a political red line they couldn't sustain crossing.
Now, beyond the political drama and the walk back, these RAFs immediately triggered legal action, right?
Immediately. The major federal employee unions, AFGE and the AFL-CIO, filed emergency motions in court trying to block the layoffs entirely.
And what's their legal argument?
Their core argument targets the specific regulation that allows RIFs, which is in the Code of Federal Regulations, 5 CFR Part 351. That rule says RIFs can happen for things like reorganization, lack of work, or a shortage of funds.
Ah, shortage of funds. That sounds like the key phrase.
Exactly. The unions are arguing that a temporary government shutdown caused by Congress failing to pass a budget is not what the regulation meant by a shortage of funds. They're saying that phrase was intended for situations where an agency's actual long-term budget is cut, or maybe it's being restructured permanently.
So they're saying a shutdown is a manufactured temporary lapse, not a genuine legal shortage of funds that justifies permanent termination.
Precisely. They see it as an illegal power grab the executive branch using temporary legislative gridlock to enact permanent, ideologically driven workforce cuts that bypass normal procedures. So the courts are now being asked to decide. Does a shutdown give the president the authority to permanently fire federal workers under this rule? That's a major legal test.
And politically, this didn't sit well even within the president's own party. I thought Republicans generally favored a harder line in shutdowns.
Generally, yes, on the shutdown itself. But using permanent RIFs, that caused a split. Some of the more moderate Republicans were really uncomfortable with it. People like Senator Susan Collins from Maine, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, they came out strongly against the RIFs.
What did they say?
Collins specifically called the attempt to permanently lay off workers punitive. That language is significant. It shows that even within the Republican caucus, there's a feeling that this went beyond a budget dispute and became about punishing federal employees. So it definitely created fissures.
Okay, so that's the offensive move, the RIFs, dismantling parts of the civilian workforce. But at the very same time, the administration played defense, making a very calculated move to protect one specific group, the military.
Yes. And politically, it was arguably a very shrewd maneuver, even if it raised some serious constitutional questions. On Saturday, October 11th, President Trump publicly directed the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, to, quote, use all available funds to get our troops paid.
The goal being to ensure the 1.3 million active duty service members got their paychecks on October 15th, despite the shutdown.
Exactly, to prevent that huge political headache of troops going without pay.
But where did the money come from? If appropriations had lapsed, how could they just find billions for payroll?
That's the crucial part. The Pentagon identified about $8 billion in funds that were appropriated in the previous fiscal year, but hadn't actually been spent or obligated to a specific contract yet. These were unobligated balances.
Okay, leftover money from last year's budget.
Specifically from the Research, Development, Testing, and Evaluation RDT&E accounts. RDT&E funds usually have a two-year lifespan before they expire, so money appropriated for fiscal year 2025 was still available, technically, even though the new fiscal year had started without a budget.
So they took money Congress had designated for research and development for future weapons and technology and used it for current payroll instead.
That's exactly what happened. They repurposed $8 billion earmarked for RDT&E to cover the immediate payroll need.
What's the impact of doing that? Using R&D funds for salaries.
Well, the immediate impact is troops get paid, which solves the political problem. But the longer-term consequence is that $8 billion worth of research, development, testing, and evaluation for future military capabilities gets delayed, cut, or canceled. It means slowing down modernization, pausing new tech development. You're essentially trading future military advantage for solving today's political crisis.
Now, let's talk about the constitutional side of this. You mentioned friction. This sounds like it steps on Congress's toes, specifically the power of the purse.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress the sole power to raise money and decide how it spent the power of the purse. Congress specifically appropriated that $8 billion for RDT&E. The president then unilaterally directed that money be used for a completely different purpose payroll without any new law from Congress authorizing that shift.
Usually, doesn't Congress have to pass a special bill during shutdowns, like the Pay Our Military Act, to allow military pay to continue?
Exactly. That's the normal constitutional process. Congress passes a law specifically authorizing payments during the funding lapse. This move completely bypassed that legislative check. It's the executive branch basically rewriting Congress's appropriations decisions on its own authority. That's a significant encroachment on legislative power.
And there was a specific group caught in the middle of this, creating a lot of anxiety, right? The Coast Guard.
Yes, that ambiguity caused real worry. The president's directive specifically mentioned the Department of Defense, but the Coast Guard, while they are a military service,
they fall under Homeland Security, not DOD.
Right. So because the directive was specifically for DOD funds and personnel, the Coast Guard was potentially left out. Their families faced the prospect of seeing Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps personnel get paid while they, performing similar duties, would not. It created this immediate sense of unfairness and uncertainty for thousands of Coast Guard members.
So, looking at this military pay move strategically, was it more brilliant politics or reckless constitutional overreach? It seems like it would really anger Congress, the very people needed to end the shutdown.
I think you have to see it as politically brilliant in the short term, almost regardless of the constitutional questions, which might get sorted out later. Why? Because it neutralized the single most potent political weapon opponents have in a shutdown.
The image of military families struggling.
Exactly. That image is politically toxic for both parties. It creates immense public pressure that usually forces a quick resolution. By taking military pay off the table unilaterally, the president removed the primary driver of urgency to compromise and end the shutdown.
So paying the military allowed the shutdown, and maybe more importantly, the RIFs against civilian workers, to continue without that massive public backlash.
That's the strategic linchpin. It provided the political cover. With the troops paid, the administration could continue pursuing its more controversial goal, the prominent RIFs of civilian employees, with significantly less immediate political heat. One move enabled the other.
Okay, so we have this escalating domestic crisis, mass layoffs, constitutional questions around military pay. But the administration wasn't just looking inward. October 11th also saw this huge escalation on the international front, creating what you called a dual crisis.
That's right. On the very same day all this domestic turmoil was peaking layoff notices going out, the military pay plan announced the president decided to throw gasoline on the fire of the ongoing trade conflict with China.
And this wasn't just tweaking existing tariffs. This was something much bigger.
Much bigger. He threatened to impose a brand new 100% tariff on essentially all goods imported from China.
100% yeah. On everything.
Yes. And he specified it would be over and above any tariff that they're currently paying. So existing tariffs plus another 100%. He set a deadline of November 1st, or possibly even sooner.
Why such a drastic move right then? What was the trigger?
The administration framed it as a direct retaliation for recent actions by Beijing that they saw as hostile. Specifically, they cited China expanding restrictions on the export of rare earth minerals.
Those are crucial for tech and defense, right?
Absolutely critical. Everything from smartphones to missile guidance systems depends on them. So that was one trigger. The other was Beijing launching a new antitrust investigation into Qualcomm, a major American semiconductor company. The 100% tariff threat was basically the nuclear option in trade terms, designed to make Chinese goods prohibitively expensive overnight.
How did the markets react to threatening an all-out trade war during a government shutdown?
Predictably badly. Global financial markets shuddered. The S&P 500 index dropped 2.7% right after the announcement, its worst single day since back in April.
What was the specific fear driving that sell-off?
Massive uncertainty. Fear of runaway inflation on consumer goods, since so much comes from China. Fear of supply chains completely breaking down. Fear of retaliatory tariffs hitting U.S. exports. And just the general instability of layering a potential global trade war onto an already dysfunctional U.S. government. Tech and manufacturing stocks got hit particularly hard.
And China's response? Did they back down?
Not at all. They came back defiant. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce put out a statement accusing the U.S. of double standards and saying China would resolutely take corresponding measures if the U.S. went ahead with the tariffs, basically promising tit-for-tat retaliation.
So global economic instability just ratcheted up several notches.
Exactly. Which brings us to that idea of the dual crisis synthesis. You've got the domestic shutdown grinding things to a halt, federal agencies crippled, economic data not being released, services slowing down. And now, layered on top, you have this major international trade war threat, causing market volatility and real fear about global economic stability.
What's the bigger picture impact of projecting that kind of chaos?
Well, it paints a picture of the U.S. as unpredictable, maybe even erratic, on the world stage. Long term, that kind of perceived instability can really erode confidence, foreign governments, international investors. they might start thinking twice about the U.S. dollar being the ultimate safe haven, or about holding U.S. Treasury bonds. It could have subtle but significant long-term consequences for America's financial standing globally.
It's quite a contrast, though, because amidst all this domestic chaos and trade war talk, there was actually a significant diplomatic achievement happening almost simultaneously, wasn't there? The Gaza ceasefire.
That's a really important counterpoint, yes. It shows the administration wasn't completely paralyzed. Its capacity was being selectively applied. A major ceasefire in Gaza, brokered by the U.S. as part of a 20-point peace plan, actually took effect right around noon local time on October 10th.
And that involved Israeli troop withdrawals and a hostage exchange plan.
Yes. Israeli forces completed their initial withdrawal, which started a 72-hour clock for Hamas to release the 48 remaining hostages. In return, Israel agreed to release 250 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences, plus another 1,700 detainees. It was a complex and significant diplomatic win.
So the ability to achieve a major foreign policy goal was there, even while domestic agencies were being hit with layoffs and shutdowns.
It really highlights the selective nature of the dysfunction. High-level diplomacy, clearly prioritized by the White House and State Department, could still function and succeed. But the routine, essential operations of many domestic agencies were being allowed to degrade or were actively being dismantled. It underscores that the domestic crisis wasn't just happening to the administration. It was in part being driven by it.
Okay, let's pivot back to the direct impact on people and services here in the U.S. Beyond the layoffs themselves, the shutdown caused a real hollowing out of basic administrative functions.
It was immediate and widespread. Let's start with the IRS again. Even before the 1,300 RAFs hit, the shutdown had already furloughed 34,400 IRS employees. That's nearly half their workforce.
Right before the October 15th tax extension deadline.
Exactly. The timing couldn't be worse. This means taxpayer services, phone lines, assistance centers were severely limited. But more importantly, it guarantees huge delays in processing tax returns, issuing refunds, handling audits. It hits average taxpayers waiting for money, and it slows down revenue collection for the government itself.
And what about help for small businesses? That often gets hit in shutdowns.
Hit hard this time. The Small Business Administration, the SBA, had to suspend approvals for almost all of its loan programs. The main ones being the 7A and 504 loans.
How critical are those loans?
They're vital lifelines for thousands of small businesses across the country, so they get capital to expand, buy equipment, hire people, manage cash flow. Cutting off those loan approvals essentially freezes a major source of capital for entrepreneurs, potentially stalling billions in local economic activity.
Scientific research also seemed to take a big hit.
A huge hit. NASA furloughed almost 83% of its workforce. That means most space missions, research projects, development of new technologies just stopped. At the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, they had to pause enrolling new patients in clinical trials. Grant applications for future research just sat there, unprocessed.
So potentially life-saving research gets delayed.
Yes. Think about trials for new cancer therapies. Alzheimer's research, if they rely on new NIH funding or patient enrollment, they were effectively put on hold. Patients waiting for potential breakthroughs are left waiting longer.
And environmental protection.
Ground to a near halt. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, had to stop most of its enforcement inspections checking if polluters are following the law. They also stopped issuing most new permits. Only skeleton crews remained for absolute emergencies. This means less oversight of industry and delays for things like construction projects that need environmental permits.
The impact wasn't just administrative. It hit culture. Tourism, daily life, especially here in Washington, D.C. The Smithsonian closing was a big, visible symbol.
It really was. The Smithsonian Museums and the National Zoo had managed to stay open for the first 10 days of the shutdown using leftover funds from the previous year. But those funds finally ran out. So starting Sunday, October 12th, everything closed.
How many institutions are we talking about?
All 17 Smithsonian Museums in D.C., the Air and Space, Natural History, American History plus the National Zoo, and 8 research centers they operate around the country, all closed to the public.
The animals at the zoo are still being cared for, presumably.
Yes. Essential animal care staff are exempt from furlough, thankfully. But for tourism, it's a massive blow. The U.S. Travel Association had already estimated, even before the Smithsonian closed, that the shutdown had cost about $1 billion in lost travel spending nationwide by October 11th.
And the Smithsonian closure specifically must cost the D.C. economy millions every day.
Absolutely. Hotels, restaurants, transportation, they all take a hit when the nation's most popular museums suddenly shut down.
And what about outside D.C.? The national park situation sounded pretty chaotic.
It was bad. Unlike the Smithsonian, most national parks remained technically open, meaning you could physically enter, but they had almost no staff. Visitor centers were closed, restrooms weren't cleaned, trash wasn't collected, campgrounds were often unstaffed.
That sounds like a recipe for safety and sanitation problems.
It was. There were reports of vandalism, illegal activities like unauthorized base jumping in Yosemite, and serious sanitation issues with overflowing trash and dirty restrooms in popular spots like Joshua Tree. And beyond the parks themselves, the surrounding towns, the gateway communities that depend on park tourism, were losing an estimated $80 million per day collectively, nationwide, during what's usually a busy fall season.
And all this disruption, the job losses, the uncertainty, it started creating real hardship for people, right? The human cost.
Definitely. Food insecurity became an immediate concern, especially in areas with lots of federal workers, like the D.C. region. Food banks started bracing for increased demand. The Capital Area Food Bank reported that even before the RIFs hit, about 41% of households affected by the shutdown were already struggling to afford food.
41% already struggling. That's grim.
It is. And that was before the permanent layoffs were finalized and the missed paychecks really started to bite.
The situation got so bad that some states actually stepped in to try and cushion the blow from the federal failure.
That was quite telling. California's Governor Newsom, for example, made a point of announcing that both furloughed and laid off federal workers in California could immediately apply for state unemployment benefits through their Employment Development Department, the EDD.
So in California, using state funds to cover workers impacted by a federal shutdown and federal layoffs.
Exactly. It's a clear example of a state trying to provide the safety net that the federal government was either failing to provide for furloughed workers,
right,
or actively dismantling for the RIF workers. It really underscores the severity of the federal dysfunction when states feel compelled to step in like that.
Okay, so we've seen the executive branch taking these aggressive actions, RIFs, military pay maneuvers, trade threats. Where were the other branches while all this was unfolding? Let's start with Congress. What was happening on Capitol Hill?
Well, essentially paralysis, which, as we talked about, really set the stage for the executive actions. On Thursday, October 10th, the Senate held votes its seventh attempt to pass legislation to end the shutdown, and both attempts failed.
Both Republican and Democratic proposals failed.
Yep. The Republican bill failed 54 to 45. The Democratic bill failed 47 to 52. Neither could get the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster.
And after that failure, what did the Senate do?
They adjourned. They packed up and went home until the following Tuesday, October 14th. That guaranteed the shutdown would continue right through the weekend, leaving the field open for the RIFs and the military pay directive to happen without any immediate legislative response.
What was the core disagreement? Why couldn't they find a compromise just to keep the government open? It wasn't just about overall spending levels, was it?
No, it had become almost entirely about specific policy writers' conditions attached to the funding bills. Democrats were digging in, refusing to pass any funding bill unless it included several key demands.
What were those demands?
They wanted an extension of the Affordable Care Act's premium tax credits, which help people afford insurance and were set to expire. They wanted to reverse some recent cuts to Medicaid funding. And they wanted language to curb the president's use of something called pocket rescissions.
Okay, pocket rescissions. Can you explain what that is and why it was such a sticking point?
Sure. A rescission is when the government cancels spending that Congress has already approved. Normally, there's a process involving Congress. Pocket rescissions, as the administration was using the term, were basically attempts by the White House to unilaterally cancel specific pots of money appropriated by Congress, often by finding ways to delay spending until the funds expired, or by interpreting budget law very aggressively.
So Democrats saw this as the president essentially line-item vetoing spending Congress had approved, undermining their power of the purse.
Exactly. They wanted to rein that practice in.
And the Republican position.
Republicans were insisting on a clean continuing resolution, or CR. That means a temporary funding bill that just keeps the government open at existing levels with no policy changes, no new spending, none of the Democratic demands. Just kick the can down the road.
So completely incompatible positions.
Total stalemate. And the key implication of this legislative paralysis, this vacuum, was that it effectively handed power over to the executive branch. Congress's inability to act and then its decision to adjourn created the space for the president to make those unilateral moves on military pay and RIFs without any immediate congressional check.
All right, so Congress was gridlocked. What about the third branch? the judiciary. They were facing their own operational problems, but also positioned to be the ultimate judge of some of these executive actions.
That's right. The federal courts themselves were running out of money. They operate partly on fees they collect and some multi-year funding, but that was set to be exhausted by Thursday, October 17th.
What happens when the courts run out of money?
They have to severely curtail operations. They can only continue functions considered essential under the Constitution, things like initial appearances in criminal cases. But most civil cases would grind to a halt. Criminal trials could be delayed, leading to huge backlogs. It threatens the basic functioning of the justice system.
And critically, the courts are where the legal challenges to the administration's actions, like the AFGE lawsuit against the RAFs, are headed.
Precisely. The judiciary is set up to be the arbiter of whether those RAFs were legal, whether that use of RDT&E funds for military pay was constitutional. But the irony is, the shutdown itself was starting to impede the court's ability to even hear those cases promptly.
How so?
We saw a concrete example when the Department of Justice itself asked a federal court, the D.C. Circuit, for a delay in a major case. Their reason? The shutdown meant their lawyers were furloughed and legally prohibited from working on the case, even voluntarily.
So the shutdown was hamstringing the government's own lawyers from defending the government's actions in court.
Exactly. It shows how the dysfunction cascades. The executive branch actions create legal challenges, but the shutdown simultaneously hinders the judicial branch's ability to resolve them.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, looking back at this incredibly intense 48-hour period, October 10th and 11th, what are the biggest long-term takeaways? These changes aren't just going to vanish when the shutdown eventually ends, are they?
Not at all. Some of the damage is potentially permanent. The first major long-term cost is the loss of institutional knowledge.
You mean from the RAFs?
Yes. When you permanently fire highly specialized civil servants, those CDC epidemiologists who've tracked diseases for decades, the senior IRS auditors who understand complex tax law, the environmental scientists, the fair housing experts, you lose expertise that takes years, sometimes a whole career, to build. That knowledge isn't easily replaced. You can't just hire someone off the street to do those jobs effectively tomorrow. This brain drain will hamper these agencies' effectiveness long after the funding is restored.
And what does doing something like mass RAFs during a shutdown do to the morale and the very idea of a professional civil service?
It sends a deeply concerning, frankly chilling, signal. The federal workforce is supposed to be based on merit, protected from political whims. Using a temporary funding fight as a justification for permanent, potentially politically targeted layoffs, it fundamentally undermines that principle. It tells remaining employees and anyone considering public service that their job security might depend less on their performance and more on the outcome of the next budget battle or the prevailing political ideology. That's incredibly corrosive to morale and recruitment.
So this really feels like more than just another shutdown. It feels like a turning point.
I think that's the most significant takeaway. October 10th and 11th, 2025, likely marked a fundamental shift in how government shutdowns are used. What used to be seen largely as a failure of governance, a passive result of gridlock, was transformed into an active political weapon.
A weapon for ideological restructuring.
Arguably, yes. The precedent has now been set. Using RIFs to permanently cut staff during a shutdown, unilaterally redirecting funds to achieve political goals like paying the military while letting other agencies suffer. This creates enormous long-term risks for the stability of government institutions and the balance of power between Congress and the president. The playbook for future shutdowns has potentially been rewritten in a much more aggressive way.
It really does feel like a watershed moment, which leads us to a final, pretty provocative thought for you, our listeners, to chew on after hearing all this.
We've just walked through how, over these 48 hours, a very sophisticated political strategy seemed to play out. The administration effectively neutralized the biggest source of pressure to end the shutdown, the imperative to pay the military.
Right, by finding that workaround with the R&D funds.
And in doing that, appeared to provide the political space needed to pursue the much more controversial goal, the permanent layoffs of thousands of civilian federal employees.
So if that main pressure point, the military pay issue, has been strategically removed from the equation, what's left?
That's the crucial question moving forward. What mechanism, what political pressure, is actually strong enough now to force Congress and the White House to reach a compromise and end this thing?
Right.
With the troops paid, has the urgency been fatally diminished for the administration?
And what does that imply about how long this particular shutdown might last now that the usual political calculus seems to have been upended?
It's a deeply concerning question, and honestly, the answer isn't clear. But understanding how we got here in these last 48 hours is critical to understanding where we might be heading.
Indeed. That's a sobering thought to end on. This has been the Federal News Update for Sunday, October 12, 2025. Thank you for joining us for the deep dive.